seasons don't fear the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain. We can be that thing. Come on, baby, don't fear the reaper. Baby, take my hand.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
The book is The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler. And in a moment, I'm going to ask him, I wonder how it goes saying things, you know, telling the American, the world, things that it doesn't want to hear. Usually in such situations, the messenger is not treated well at all. I'd like to remind my audience that a very great deal of the information I use, and incidentally, that relates to the long emergency, the article sent to me that I ended up reading. A lot of these things, most of them I use on the show, are sent to me. So if you have something of great interest, an article or anything at all, really, I'm available on the Internet, of course, artbell at mindspring.com or artbell at AOL.com. That's A-R-T-B-E-L-L at mindspring.com or AOL. .com. Now, James, generally when somebody like yourself writes something like you've written, you know, you're telling people things they really, really don't want to hear. As you point out, we're sleepwalking through this, and they don't want to hear the kinds of things you've said tonight. So how's it gone down? I mean, the messenger is usually shot in situations like this.
Well, it's a little early to tell with my book, The Long Emergency. I can tell how my friends and associates around here where I live have reacted to these ideas.
How's it going?
Well, generally, my friends around here are, you know, yuppie professionals. They tend to be politically progressive.
Living in the suburbs, mostly.
Well, I live in small town America. I live in upstate New York. In a classic American Main Street town, that does have its suburban components, but my friends tend to scoff at these ideas. They find the idea of the long emergency or the idea that we're really heading into big problems with energy to be rather abstract and not real. And I don't try to really. I don't try to persuade them to see things from my point of view. It seems rather futile. I just try to present the facts and draw some conclusions about it and let people decide for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I haven't been persecuted a whole lot. There was it's a little bit early in the publication cycle. The actual official pub date is not until May 15th. So there haven't been major reviews yet. I believe there was one in the New Republic about a week ago, and the title of it was Wise Fool.
Wise Fool, really?
It was an equivocal review, and what he said in a nutshell was, these ideas that Kunstler is retailing seem pretty far out, and I'm not sure whether we can believe him or not, but they also seem maybe kind of plausible, and maybe we ought to take them seriously. So he really didn't know which way to go, finally, and I imagine there'll be a lot more of that. But as I said earlier, you know, I'm allergic to conspiracy theories. I think people generally overplay them, and I don't think that there will be any, conspiracy to keep this information away from the public.
Unless it's by the public themselves, wanting to hear it.
I hold the public very much accountable for their own predicament. The public wanted to build this suburban drive-in utopia for themselves, and they've gotten exactly what they wanted. You know, I see this a lot in the struggles that have occurred over Walmart over the last 20 years, because I've been, you know, often brought into various communities to help some battle against a Walmart here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is there's always some sizable faction of the local population that wants the Walmart very badly. Now, in my opinion, they're often making a choice that goes very much against the self-interest of their community, because the Walmart will come in and, in effect, destroy their local economy. And it's happened time and time and time again, and we've all seen it. And yet, Americans have not been able to make the connection that, you know, that there's a reason why it's important to have a local class of people engaged in retail and wholesale, and these fine networks of economic interdependency, and why they matter to a locality. Americans have basically sold themselves down the river to save $9 on a hairdryer, and they've done it time and time and time again. So our own behavior collectively has been somewhat foolish over the last, through the post-war period, and accelerating, especially in the last 20 years or so.
I live in a small community, indeed, and recently a Super Walmart opened here, uh-huh. James, and there was, for the most part, a townwide celebration when
sure.
it opened.
But, of course, you know, you're living in one of those towns out west that really sprung up about 20 minutes ago. That did not have really a deep and long, infrastructure of commercial stuff and families running business going back for generations.
Quite right.
You know, but here, back in the older parts of the United States where that's the case, you see tremendous devastation. Most of the towns in the eastern United States now look like a former Soviet backwater. They are so dead. You know, and the desolation is so visible. The boarded up storefronts, the shut down factories, the empty streets.
A number of houses
that are not taken care of.
I remember going through parts of Kansas that were the most depressing sight I ever saw. As you pointed out, stores boarded up, towns virtually dead.
Startling.
Depressing. Yes, I found it.
And many of these towns 30 years ago were vibrant towns with local economies. They manufactured things, and the local retail economies mostly functioned on a local and regional basis. We had local bakeries and local creameries and wholesalers of goods that were manufactured in the United States, and we had a comprehensive economy. We're moving into something quite different now after a long period of sort of shock.
All right. I want to go to the phones, allow the audience to ask some questions. First-time caller line, you're on the air with James Kunstler. Hello.
Mr. Kunstler, my name is Jim. I am calling from Rochester, New York. I assume you're a neighbor.
Well, I'm east of you somewhat by about 200 miles. I'm over sort of near the Vermont border.
Okay. The reason I'm calling is because I realize how daunting all this information could be to most people that hear this for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some optimism that can be taken away in an example that's been set nearby where I'm from, which is, I mentioned Rochester, New York, Ithaca, which is a town that's created its own currency. And what that's done is essentially reverse the trends of export-based economies into essentially a localized economy where everything in the local is favored. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
I'd like to know, caller, explain what you mean their own currency.
Well, what they've done is essentially create their own currency. It's been entrenched since 1991. It's legal. There's been videos about it. It's actually been on national news. And what it's done is essentially reverse all the trends that are negative towards pushing us to this state of being we don't want to be in.
James?
Yes.
Well, I know about the Ithaca experiment. You know, they still use the U.S. dollar in Ithaca, New York, and mainly. The Ithaca experiment has been kind of an idealistic, cooperative experiment to construct a network of favors and barter and the ability to obtain local services and to promote that idea. And it's been a good-hearted experiment. I'm not sure that it really is the way we're going to be doing stuff in the future in America. I imagine we're still going to be using the dollar. The dollar may have quite a bit less value. We may see quite a bit of barter. Sometimes I think that we're going to be living in garage sale nation.
That's similar to what that community is like.
Pardon me?
That's very similar to what that community is like.
Yeah.
They have a lot of co-op farming. They have a lot of... Everything is very locally controlled, locally oriented, and I think it's something that's gone very far in helping insulate their community towards the effects of what we're going to see to come.
So this so-called currency was an effort to sort of localize the economy. As
exactly.
Well as
it's called the Ithaca Hour.
All right. I've got it. Thank you. So you don't think that James, as a possible successful model?
Well, I see it as a noble, small-scale, local experiment, but not necessarily something that has widespread implications for what's really going to happen in the States. And, you know, it's also among a fractional population of the people who live there.
All right. Right now, we consider the United States the last great surviving superpower. Is that a fair assessment? Is that what we are right now?
Well, the Soviet Union, or the former Soviet Union, Russia, has in fact actually more nuclear armaments than we do.
So I'm speaking economically.
Yeah, they're still pretty super.
Yeah.
I don't know. I happen to believe that our economy is largely a sort of hallucinated economy right now. We're kind of levitating, kind of running on fumes. And it wouldn't take much to kind of knock the hallucinated props out from under it. And all of this implies that we may have less of an ability to project our power internationally than we believe that we do. I mean, we certainly have airplanes and nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and bombs and rockets and things, but you know, we're already proving that just to occupy one unfriendly nation is a very difficult enterprise and not something that we could necessarily sustain for a long period of time. So I think that we probably will withdraw back into the Western Hemisphere, and the world will be a larger place.
And that will be again, you're projecting the beginning of the really tough times in about 3 years. So when do we begin withdrawing? Is there a way to foresee that?
Oh, you know, I think that any reasonable person could look at the situation and say, well, we're probably not going to be, you know, do we stay in Iraq for 2 years, two more years? 4 more years, 6 years, what seems really reasonable? And at what point do we start exhausting our military and bankrupting our treasury in doing that? I think that you could come up with a range of time that most people could agree on, you know, probably something between, you know, the next 12 and 48 months, well, we're going to have to decide whether we stick around there.
All right.
A lot of people talk about the possibility, the prospect of occupying Saudi Arabia for one reason or another, you know, mainly to protect our access to their oil.
That's right.
And in the event of some kind of a thing like a coup d'etat or a threat to the Saudi family or some kind of terrorism against the infrastructure of Iraq, of Saudi Arabia.
We could not allow that to occur, could we?
Well, we say that, but I don't think that we could really prevent it. Could we occupy Saudi Arabia and even control the terrain there? I doubt it after our experience in Iraq. Could we protect the oil infrastructure? Well, the conventional wisdom is that all you need is 5 pounds of Semtex plastic explosive and a camel, and you can blow up the most important pipeline that runs across Saudi Arabia from Riyadh to Jeddah.
All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with James Howard Kunstler. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Michael from Indio, California.
Yes,
which is not a very well-to-do but rapidly growing community, which is like a mixture of Middle America and the Southwest, as he was describing.
All right.
I do predict, and I'm only 25 years old, that I predict in 25 years the United States will become like the former Soviet Union. That's what I predict, and I'm only 25, and I have a very good knowledge because I paid attention to our deteriorating public school history courses.
All right. Education is another interesting question to ask, how it will fare through all of this. Could it go that quickly, James, really, in the next 5 years? Could we be like the former Soviet Union?
Well, I think the prospects are pretty grim. I happen to be in a high school last week. Now, I don't have any kids. I've been married a couple of times. I don't have any kids. But I did give a lecture on Earth Day at a large, mega-large suburban high school here in the New York Capital District on Earth Day. And I was astounded at how out of control, how rude, how stupid the kids were who were there. They didn't want to pay attention. Their teachers had no control over them. And I had to throw two kids out of the auditorium myself because the kids, the teachers wouldn't do it, wouldn't control the kids.
Goodness.
I asked them later, you know, why don't you control their behavior? And they said, well, we can. You know, there are these elaborate bureaucratic procedures we have to go through to control them. And it was shocking to go to this school. Anyway, it happens to be my belief that what we are going to see is that our large centralized school districts will not work very well for us anymore. You know, for very similar reasons to the other things in suburbia failing us. These schools that depend on these fleets of yellow school buses to drive hundreds or even thousands of miles every day, they're very hard to heat because they're all one-story buildings. Moreover, I think education itself is going to change. Right now, American high school amounts to very little besides an elaborate babysitting service. You know, some kids do succeed at it on its own terms, but even they suffer from the futility of it. And I have a feeling what we will see is schooling becoming much smaller, taking place on a much more distributed basis around the places we live, in smaller physical places, and that schooling for many people may not go past the eighth grade 10, 20 years from now. I think the college is going to cease to be a mass consumer activity in the sense that it is today, and it will return, if at all, to being an activity for the elite. Now, how much resentment and grievance that generates among the people who are disentitled from it remains to be seen. I think a lot of large universities are going to dry up and blow away. Mm-hmm. We're simply going to be a much less affluent society, and we're probably not going to be able to run many of these great universities, including the great land-grant diploma mills of the Midwest.
My God, James, I consider myself to be pretty cynical, and I don't know, I look at the negative side of things, but you make me look like a piker. I mean, you really have a kind of a bleak outlook for everything, and in the very near term at that, huh?
Well, I don't consider myself bleak or cynical at all. In fact, I'm a relatively cheerful person, and I lead a relatively happy life. What I'm doing is looking at the circumstances of our society and making, I think, some reasonable projections about where we're going with this. And one thing you have to remember, you know, a major discontinuity in the patterns of life is not necessarily the end of the world.
No.
A lot of people accuse me of being apocalyptic. And I rather resent that label because I'm not describing the end of the world. I'm describing major changes that we're going to go through in American civilization that are going to change the way we do things. It may be a convulsion. It may be full of hardship, but it's not the end of the world.
A realignment of the world, though, certainly.
Well, yes.
Our world.
I'll
and
agree with that.
Have you done any personal planning based on what you know?
Well, I made some of the decisions that I did make quite a few years ago. I grew up in New York City, and I lived in many major cities when I was a young newspaper reporter. And I decided to move to a Main Street town 30 years ago, and I've been here ever since writing books.
You're indeed the exact kind of place that he suggests will make out best in the long emergency. What do you say, folks? You buying into this? Or do you think there'll be a miracle? That's something we need to ask more about, that possibility of a miracle, something new, radical. Energy producing. Free energy! Better happen. Otherwise, the road we're on is the one described in The Long Emergency. Good morning. I'm Art Bell.
Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Perhaps nothing is as it seems. Good morning. James Howard Kunstler is my guest, and what a dire message he carries. The book is called The Long Emergency.
Which of the...
If you imagine the economic social changes that have been outlined tonight by my guest, then you have to imagine a drastic change in politics, because that reflects, of course, what's going on. And so how will American politics change through this period of time? Any projections?
From me, Art?
Yes.
Ah, well, we were talking a while ago about this new phenomenon that I think we'll be seeing in the years ahead, the formation of what I call a formerly middle class, a large former middle class.
Yes.
And they will be full of grievances and resentment, and they will be bewildered by the loss of their entitlements to life in a drive-in utopia. And I think that they may even be so angry that they will vote for cornpone Nazis or people like that, people who will make George Bush look very mild indeed in comparison.
Really?
Now, having said that, I have to qualify that by adding that I think that the federal government will become progressively less powerful rather than more powerful in the years ahead. And remember, I said anything big, anything on the large scale, whether
including
it's,
government.
Yeah, whether it's government or Walmart or large industrial Cargill-type farming operations, anything big is going to wither during the long emergency. And a lot of my friends are very disturbed about the prospect of a big brother government controlling their lives, you know. I think that we'll be lucky if the federal government can answer the phone 20 years from now. And that, let alone regulate our lives.
All right. First
but
time.
I do think on the local basis, we're liable to see a lot of extremism, and some of it may be quite dangerous, because it will involve things like scapegoating and blaming our problems on various groups of people. I think justice is liable to be a lot swifter and cruder. We're going to not tolerate misbehavior, and we're going to deal with it probably fairly swiftly.
You make the world government almost sound good. But first-time caller line, you're on the air with James Howard Kunstler. Good morning.
Right, that was almost a perfect segue you gave me. I can give you three quick examples. You talk about big things withering. You, Mr. and Mrs. Taxpayer, and all those listening, just finished, as an example, paying via your tax dollars for something big that's withering in Boston. We had a great idea to try and move traffic along by creating the well-known Big Dig. Now we find we're residing to driving wooden pegs into the sidewalls of the Big Dig tunnel going through Boston Harbor to keep the water out. It simply is failing miserably, and this is a perfect example of big government withering by trying to move traffic, which you simply can't do. When traffic gets to a certain level, there's nothing you can do. Another example, ever tried driving through the 405, known as the Jug Handle in Southern California? What's the government want to do there? Well, let's put up toll booths. The drivers are already paying 50 cents a gallon in taxes. Now they're going to try and sustain or foist tolls on top of that. It simply will fail miserably. You live up in the Lakes region in New York. Isn't it sad to see that some of the lakes down there now are unfishable? There's hydrazine in the water, which turns male animals into female. The hydrazine converts testosterone into progesterone and changes the males into females. These are telltale signs of things that are happening now. We don't have to prognosticate and say, oh, well, this is what's going to happen. These signs are happening around us all over the place, and the sooner people wake up and realize what you're saying is really on target, the better we'll be. The government we elect is the government we get, and unless we're willing to make a drastic change in how things are run, I'm afraid we're going to go down this path sooner than later.
All right. Well, I don't think the American people are at all prepared to make the kinds of choices that are being discussed this morning. I just don't think they are. And
there are two points the gentleman made that I think are kind of interesting. You know, one is he's generally describing what I would call the diminishing returns of technology,
mm-hmm.
meaning that, you know, we think that technology is only a benefit in our lives, but in fact, it bites back a lot. And so we have this big project in Boston where we tried to put the expressway underneath the city, and it turned out to be very problematical. You know, this leads to a consideration of another big problem, though. A lot of Americans are confused about the difference between technology and energy. often in this public discussion, you'll hear people say, new technology will help solve these problems for us.
Right.
But the problem isn't the technology. The problem is the energy that the technology runs on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can find new technology all day long for all sorts of things. You know, everything from, you know, running rock and roll music through your eardrums to, you know, running a Volkswagen on the residue of a French fry machine. But, you know, if you don't have the basic energy to run these things, then it sort of doesn't matter what kind of technology you come up with.
Are you truly convinced, James, that there will not be some technological breakthrough in the area of energy? I mean, that is a possibility.
I would put it differently, although I've said that more or less. What I am saying is that even if some miracle occurs and we discover some source of energy that we hadn't known about before, or some
right.
way of using the things that we've got that we didn't know about before, there will still be this period of hardship and turbulence
True.
That we're going to go through that I call the long emergency. So I see the period itself as being really quite unavoidable. But I wouldn't completely foreclose the idea that the human race will discover some other way of running things.
Right.
It may be.
But even if they do, the transitional period is still going to be that same long emergency.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, quite frankly, the prospect that the carrying capacity of the Earth for the numbers of human beings that are now living on it really has been exceeded. And whatever else happens, we're probably going to have to, you know, die back to a more sustainable population. Now, whether that happens, you know, over several generations or, you know, a millennium or just a couple of decades is a question that's up in the air, and it's not necessarily something that I advocate one way or the other. You know, something will happen, but I wouldn't want to advocate for it one way or the other.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with James Howard Kunstler. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Esther from New York on WABC.
Yes, Esther.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, individualism, the hyper-individualism, we should realize that if you give up the...
Where'd you go? Let's try it again. Are you still there?
Hello, Martin.
Okay, we've got some cross lines here. Is this you, young lady?
I'm here.
Good, okay, please continue.
Yeah. You mentioned about the synthetic fuels, so I'll go on to another subject. I think that the individualism to drive, you know, 30, 50 miles should be given up because it would be a patriotic thing to do and to keep the American way of life, to be able to go to the drugstore, you know, make these little trips. And also, I think that if they design railroads, that they should make the subway cars or other cars, you know, more human-friendly. You do feel like you're giving up, that you're a failure if you go into one of these things. So if they make them prettier and make them, you know, more user-friendly, make you feel more important going into them. One example, in the old subway cars, they used to have them like 16 people together, you know, like a little rectangle, and now you have these long lines, and you really feel like a real failure in them. So if they make these things, you know, more they make people feel more important.
All right. Well, it's a very good point, and you know, but it goes to our leadership. And again, there's a gigantic apparent failure of leadership going on, right?
Well, I don't know if I would attribute that to the design of subway cars.
No, but a move toward a mass transit system. I mean, these are things that only really government can do.
Well, yes, you do need some agreement at all levels of government that these things are necessary. Right now, we're having a debate in Congress about allocating, you know, something like $1.8 billion to saving Amtrak. You know, we're spending $80 billion in Iraq, and a lot of it to fix the sewers and electrical systems of Iraq, and we're not even willing to spend a small fraction of that, maintaining our existing rail system. And You know, it's true. We have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of at this point. And we have to do better. I don't happen to agree with the caller that Americans are going to voluntarily step out of their cars and stop driving individually.
I don't think so.
Just out of patriotism. They will stop doing that when they're compelled to do it by circumstances and not before.
All right. East of the Rockies. Your turn with James Howard Kunstler. Good morning. Hello?
Is it?
Yes.
It's Michael.
Yes, Michael.
Okay. You are a hard person to get a hold of.
Yes.
Fine for a week, man.
All right. You're through now, Michael, so let her rip.
This is Michael, Fort Walton Beach.
I can tell that you're on some kind of internet connection. Not a very good one, either.
Skype. Is that bad?
It's not great.
Yeah.
Look, go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. No question. I have all the answers.
Okay. Well, then give us one.
Okay, give us one. Okay, one answer. No need to worry about oil, because in 20 years, 90% of the world is going to be covered in water anyway.
I need oil. You're not Skyping very well.
We need solar power.
Okay, there you are. So, James, there is one answer.
Well, global warming is happening. Climate change is happening. There's very little disagreement in the scientific community about that. And we're going to be facing some additional problems. You know, in my opinion, this has most significance for our food production issues, because not only are we going to be facing the loss of oil and gas inputs, but we're going to be facing some very strange and perhaps devastating climate issues, you know, years of drought, the inability to grow certain crops that we have been accustomed to growing in certain parts of the year.
Yes.
Desertification of places that only receive marginal amounts of rainfall. These things are all going to be part of the bigger picture of the emergency that we're facing.
James, how much of a possibility is there that your timetable is askew? That I'm not disputing what you're saying is coming, but that it may be a little farther away than you're suggesting.
I think that, if anything, the problems that we're going to encounter with oil are closer. And I think that because of this reason, that you don't have to run out of oil or even go very far down the arc of depletion before the major systems that we depend on start to destabilize and wobble and mutually amplify each other's distress.
Mm-hmm.
So that when, you know, the price of oil goes up even moderately, that's when the big box retail stores start to, you know, have trouble with their business equation. Agricultural producers start to have trouble with justifying their production. That's when people start losing jobs. That's when the air starts coming out of the economy. That's when people discover that the investments they've made may not be worth what they thought they were. And all sorts of things start affecting each other and wobbling, and pretty soon you find yourself, you know, in the beginning, in a very, very difficult economic situation. You know, and then you're confronted with the realities of really how you're going to use these infrastructures of daily life that are really seriously failing you.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James Howard Kunstler. Hello.
Well, good morning, Art and James. This is Carrie in California, and what I want to say is there is a way of making extra fuel by just breaking the molecules down of water into hydrogen and oxygen. I've already been working towards that. I've completely making my own power now in my own motorhome and living in it, and hey, as soon as I can get the other parts I need to convert and start making my own hydrogen, I'm going to.
All right. Well, he's not the only one talking about hydrogen, James. The president had a lot to say about hydrogen. How much of the equation is it?
Well, we're unlikely to have a hydrogen economy, at least the way the president described it. We can make hydrogen and we can use hydrogen, but it's almost, you know, you get less energy from the hydrogen that you than you you have to put more energy into the process of getting the hydrogen than you get from the hydrogen itself, and that's a general truth of the system.
In other words, it's a net loss.
It's a net loss. Hydrogen's not really a fuel source. It's just a sort of a carrier for the energy that's produced by something else. Generally, electricity. It takes electricity to separate hydrogen from the oxygen in water, and you get less energy from the hydrogen than you put in the electricity.
Well, then the president has to know that. If he knows that, then what's he doing? Just trying to calm everybody down, or what?
Yeah, and I think there was also this idea that we would construct an enormous number of nuclear electric generating plants to get the hydrogen, and that we would be running the easy motoring system of America, the interstate highway and all of its furnishings on hydrogen. But I think what you find really with hydrogen is that it doesn't scale. That's sort of an engineering term. It doesn't scale. And it's true of a lot of the alternative fuel things. You can do them on a small basis. You may be able to do them on a household basis or even on a neighborhood basis. But we're not going to be able to run the systems of American society as presently constituted on these things.
I would take it right now. Your book, The Long Emergency, is available Amazon.com, all the bookstores. That
yeah,
sort of
Borders,
thing.
Barnes & Noble, the independent booksellers. Let's not forget them, the people organized under BookSense.com.
How's it doing so far?
Well, I don't know. I think it's coming out of the box pretty well. There are a lot of people out there who recognize there's a problem, who would like to hear it articulated in a rational way and are interested in where we're going and what we're going to do. And especially the young people out there who are going to be living most of their lives in an America that's quite different from the one that we've been used to.
And do you think, based on this information, people are beginning to make personal choices, actual decisions?
Oh, yes. I get emails every day from people who are making real plans to move to different places, people who are going to leave Los Angeles, for example, and recognize that that may be one of the more difficult places to be, people who are thinking of new trades and vocations, people who are in college learning things that they know that they will never be able to make a career of, like, public relations or marketing, things that are not going to be vocations 30 years from now when they're my age.
All right. Well, we're going to have to hold it right there. We're out of time, but boy, you sure laid it on the line, brother.
Well, it was a pleasure to be here and to talk to your audience, and I hope that you all got something out of it.
Thank you, my friend.
And I wish you good luck in the long emergency.
Thank you. I'll need it based on where I am. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, James Howard Kunstler, everybody. That's it. That's the weekend. See you next weekend. It's been a great one from the high desert, the doomed high desert. I'm Art Bell. Good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. You with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you?